is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040465, City of Houston versus Robert Jackson from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals District. Docket number 040641, Nick Giuseppe, DBA Southbrook Development Company and Frisco Master Plan versus Roger Lawler from Collin County in the Fifth Court of Appeals District. Justice Medina will not be sitting in that case. Docket number 040692, Guide One Elite Insurance Company, formerly known as Preferred Abstainers Insurance Company, versus Fielder Road Baptist Church from Tarrant County and the Second Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between each argument. We expect to conclude all arguments by noon today. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. The court is now ready to hear argument in 040465, the City of Houston versus Robert Jackson.
May it please the court, David Holden will present argument to the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. May it please the court. I, together with my co-counsel, Mr. Tim Higley, represent the City of Houston. The City of Houston has raised a number of points in its petition for review. I would like to address three of them: jurisdiction, excessive fines, and no evidence. I think it's proper to address jurisdiction first because jurisdiction is dispositive. That is, if the statute does not provide the trial court with jurisdiction to impose a penalty, then the judgment has to be reversed and rendered. Now, in this case, Jackson complains, he's a firefighter, he complains that he was denied a transfer pursuant to a recommendation from a grievance examiner under Section 143.130 of the Texas Local Government Code. That's important. There, it's undisputed that the grievance examiner's recommendation was done pursuant to 143.130 of the Texas Local Government Code. Now, the statute upon which he asked this court to impose a penalty is 143.134H of the Texas Local Government Code. And that statute says that the court can impose a penalty of $1,000 a day for every day the fire chief intentionally fails to implement a decision by the commission, Civil Service Commission, under 143.131, or a hearing officer's decision under 143.129. Now, I'm giving you a lot of numbers, but the important point is 143.120 is not mentioned in the statute. The very statute upon which they're seeking to impose liability does not talk about 143.130, and that's the very recommendation that Jackson wishes to have this court impose a $1,000 a day penalty. Now, why do we know that 143.130 is not applicable in this statute? It's because this is a penal statute. It's a punitive statute. And this court has said on many occasions that punitive statutes, penal statutes, are strictly construed. Also, it is a statute that waives governmental immunity. This court has said on many occasions that statutes that waive governmental immunity are strictly construed. Also, this is a statute that's clear and unambiguous. There's no way to read anything else into, except for the two situations in which the court said you can impose a penalty, 143.131 and 143.129. Those are the only provisions. Now, when a statute is clear and unambiguous, this court has said we apply the statute as written. We don't make policy. We don't try to rewrite the statute. We don't even apply the rules of statutory construction. If something is excluded from a statute, the court says that's excluded for a purpose.
Mr. Holman, that statute talks about the knowledge of the chief.
How is it, or how is it not, that the knowledge of a subordinate is not directed to the knowledge of the chief in this instance?
Well, there's two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, once again, the penal statutes are strictly construed. So if it says the fire chief intentionally did it, it doesn't mean other folks did it. It means that the fire chief did it, rather than his delegates or representatives. As we pointed out in the reply brief, there are many provisions in the statute that refer to the department head and his designated representative. The department head and his representative. The department head or his designee. Those statutes indicate that when the legislature wanted to include others besides the fire chief, they did. In this particular statute, it only talks about the fire chief. Also, we cited many cases in our brief that talked about imposing respondeat superior or liability on the municipality. And this court has said on numerous occasions that you cannot impose respondeat superior or liability on a municipality. And we don't have that situation here anyway, because we have a statute that speaks directly to a fire chief. We have a situation where the only way to get to 143.130, which is Ms. Corey's grievance recommendation, the only way to get to that is to add words into the statute. And this court has said on many times, we don't add words into
the
statute.
Well, let me ask you how this works. If you're at the step three grievance stage, which the parties were,
correct,
and the grievance examiner enters a decision or a recommendation,
correct,
and neither party appeals, and neither party here really had any reason to appeal,
right,
then they accept the agreement.
Correct.
And I think it's your argument that it never gets to the 131 that's subject to
true
penalty. So the parties accept the agreement. What if one party breaches the agreement? I know you said it did, but let's just say the city said we're not going to follow it. Your argument is H wouldn't kick in, but what happens then?
Well, I believe that there's two things that you could do. First of all, the grievant could go up through the chain of command, and he's permitted to do that.
How?
Well, he can go to his superior, go to his superior and so forth, and try to get relief that way.
Informally?
Informally. Because this is in, under step three,
it's
an
informal, right?
Under step three, 143.130, it's an informal administrative procedure, and there's only a recommendation given. It's not a final decision.
So you go up informally and you say, transfer me,
right,
please do this, which apparently he did.
And if, and if they don't do it that way, which is, you know, the way that you'd normally approach a problem with the city government, then you can file another grievance.
Which
under 127A1, which he did.
He did.
And he got his transfer, finally. Okay? The important point is that's completely removed from the penalty.
I understand your point, but I guess what I'm trying to figure out here is he seems a bit whipsawed through the system. He tried informally. He tried formally, and his grievance was dismissed. So what are you left with? I understand you're saying you're not left with the penalty, but he tried both of those. What do you do? And that seemed to disturb the Court of Appeals in Jackson 1.
I agree that it disturbed the Court of Appeals in Jackson 1. But the way to approach that is not to create a remedy that the legislature did not create.
I understand, but what was he to do?
Well, as I say, he could file another grievance, and he actually filed a grievance on the 72D transfer, rather than a grievance to say, you didn't give me 11D. But then he did complain in his 72D step 2 hearing that because you didn't give me 11D, give me 72D as a settlement.
I understand, but that was dismissed. So you're saying
right,
he should have then gone to step three to appeal the dismissal?
Well, it was dismissed because he didn't file a step three grievance procedure timely. That's the only reason that grievance was dismissed. And he filed it it's supposed to be filed within 15 days of the step two denial when he receives it, and he filed it 16 days after.
But I thought it was dismissed. I thought he was told it was dismissed because it was already the subject of another grievance procedure, and it couldn't be brought twice.
That was the other one that Chief Britt denied. The 72D was the one that Leggio denied, and that was dismissed because there was he hadn't gone to the step three procedure properly, timely. But I mean, there are provisions to do it. The legislature did not provide, however, for a $1,000 a day penalty for a step three grievance.
I understand. I'm just trying to figure out if you've got an agreement you've both accepted after step three, and neither party goes to step four, how do you enforce it?
Well, as I said, the only way you can enforce it is file another grievance. The 143.127A says that you can file a grievance over a transfer. And although it says in 127A1 that you can't file a grievance over any action that you've already had a hearing on, he can file a grievance to complain about the grievance process. And that's what he would be doing, filing a grievance to complain about the grievance process, which he never did. There are options available to him. But the thing is, this option of the $1,000 penalty is not available, and that's what he seeks to recover here. And because it's not available under the statute, there's no jurisdiction. The trial court had no jurisdiction to impose a penalty on the city. Now, why?
So your enforcement mechanism of something you've achieved through the system, or to enforce it, is to start over with another grievance for enforcement.
Right. Let me state this in another way. 129 is a step two procedure. Okay? After you get done with the step two procedure, you can go one of two ways. You can either go to an arbitration with a hearing examiner, or you can go to a step three procedure. Okay? If you get to a step three procedure, you can go either accept that, the recommendation, the grievance examiner's recommendation for solution, or you can go to step four to get a final decision from the Civil Service Commission. What the statute talks about is a final decision from a hearing examiner, which would be the arbitrator under 129, or a final decision under 131, the Civil Service Commission. That makes sense. If you have a final decision that's binding on the parties, final and binding either by the Civil Service Commission or by an independent hearing examiner, then, and the fire chief intentionally refuses to carry that out, then you can penalize them $1,000 a day. But if you have a grievance examiner's recommendation, the parties informally accept it, and there's no provision in the statute for that to trigger the $1,000 a day penalty, then the trial court doesn't have jurisdiction.
Now, why isn't the clarification that was written by the hearing officer, why is that not valid? In light of the request, as I understand it, the request was made by the city.
The Alice Perrineau testified about that, Your Honor, and Alice Perrineau was the senior director of the Human Resources Department. And she testified that she sought it on her own. She sought it because she was trying to see how to implement it. It wasn't the statute. Step three procedure provides that you have 15 days to appeal to the Civil Service Commission. And that wasn't done by either party. This wasn't an appeal to the Civil Service Commission. It was a request for clarification. And the Civil Service Commission never acted upon it. So it never triggered anything under the four-step grievance procedure. Now we have two other arguments. One of them is the excessive fines argument, and one of them is the no evidence argument. And I believe Your Honors can address the no evidence argument because it's our provision, it's our position that if you go through this record, you will find no evidence, direct or circumstantial, that the fire chief either knew of Ms. Korod's recommendation or that he intentionally failed to implement it. Now, as this court said in the City of Keller versus Wilson, it's not a new or should have known standard. It's a new standard, K-N-E-W. It's an intentional standard. You have to have intent to violate the statute. And you can't create intent where there is none. And this statute doesn't talk about what the fire chief did. This record doesn't talk about what the fire chief did, doesn't talk about what the fire chief who the fire chief talked to, doesn't talk about any documents that the fire chief ever wrote or reviewed, doesn't talk about anything to do with the fire chief. And you can't get there because this is a penal statute that's strictly construed. You can't get there through the acts of representatives. It has to be the fire chief's intent alone. Now let me talk about excessive fines. The operative case that I think that you all should look at is the first case that we cite in our brief of the merits, which is a case called State versus Galveston. It's a 1906 case from this court. And the facts of that case were that there was a $20 fine, daily fine, that was levied for detention of taxes. For a year, that would amount to $73,000 in taxes. The taxes that they were detaining were only $74,000. The court looked at that and said, wait a minute. That's grossly disproportionate to the amount of the damages. And therefore, because it's grossly disproportionate to the amount of damages, it's excessive and it's void. Now, there's another case that we haven't cited in the brief, but I came across in my research, and I'd like to give you the cite to that. Missouri Pacific versus Tucker. It's a United States Supreme Court case, 230 U.S. 340. It's a 1913 case. But I think it's very illustrative of the principles governing excessive fines. Here's what the provision is. It was a provision that governed rates that railroads could charge. In this particular case, it said that if the railroad doesn't charge you the proper rate, they're automatically hit with a $500 fine. So this guy was a passenger on a railroad, and he got charged $3 more than he should have been charged. He trotted off to court and said, I want my $500, and I want an attorney's fee as well. And the court looked at that, and they said, wait a minute. That's grossly disproportionate. I'm sorry, I see my time's up. Expired. May I have a few moments to conclude?
Are there any further questions? You can address this. Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Okay, please, the court, with Joe Bay, will present argument from the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Joan Bain, and my co-counsel is Fred Keyes. We represent the respondent, Robert Jackson. First, I'd like to address some of the court's questions from opening regarding the statute itself, 134H. Mr. Holman and the city are incorrect in their interpretation that the grievance examiner's decision in this case is not implicated by Section 131, which is specifically referred to in 134H. I've given the court a handout. It was attached to my brief, and I submitted it again this morning, which is a diagram of the statute and the procedures, the parallel procedures that are available to a firefighter under the grievance procedures of the statute as a whole. And it's important for the court to remember that when you're construing a statute such as the Civil Service Code, you're not supposed to look just to that one isolated section. You're supposed to look to the entire statute and give effect to the statute. What's significant about 134H is that it does not reference 129B or D. It references Section 129 in its entirety. It also does not reference 131A or C. It references Section 131 in its entirety. Now, the process through which a firefighter may pursue a grievance splits when you get to step three, and that's when you have your choice of going to an independent hearing examiner under Section 143.057 versus the commission's hearing examiner under Section 143.130. Once you make that choice, you have to follow the appropriate path for that choice. You can't switch back and forth between them. The city has accused the petitioner and the court of adding provisions to the statute, but really what's happened here is the city's failed to acknowledge that a grievance examiner's decision under Section 130 becomes final by operation of Section 131A. That is the operative statutory provision which makes the decision final when no one appeals it. If, however, someone does appeal it.
But 143.130 makes it final by its own terms.
It deems it accepted, but it becomes the decision of the commission by virtue of 131A. Additionally, in this case, we have testimony from Alice Perrineau that the commission actually adopted the decision.
Well, what? Show me where in 143.131A the commission adopts it as final. It says if either one disagrees, they can file a step four and file it, but it doesn't say anything about we accept it or it becomes our decision.
That's correct. It says that 131 is what makes it final. It becomes final.
I hear you say that. I'm trying to find it in the text.
The word final? Is that what you're asking me?
Well,
131 is the provision that says if no one appeals to step four, it becomes final.
Where does it say that?
Because it says that. It's implied, I guess. It's deemed accepted. It becomes the agreement of the parties.
I don't see that anywhere in here. I mean, I hear you. But all this just says is if you're going to appeal it, here's how you do it.
Correct. And if you don't do it, it's deemed accepted.
You're implying that.
I mean, what I'm saying is this is a mandatory provision. It says if you do not want the proposed solution, you must go through a step four grievance with the director within 15 calendar days. If you don't, I mean, the natural consequence is if you don't, you have not exhausted your administrative remedies.
But that's like saying we've got separate trap rules for courts and the Supreme Court. But the trap rules say when a court of appeals judgment is final, you can still appeal. But that's like saying, well, because you didn't appeal, therefore these rules say that one's final. That doesn't really follow, does it?
It does, because when you put that in the context of the law as a whole, that cuts off the firefighter's right to take it to a court, and or the city's right to take it to a court, because you have not exhausted your administrative remedies. So if Mr. Jackson, for example, in this case, wanted to reject the solution, and he did not file this step four grievance procedure, he would not be able to appeal to the district court.
But that's a very different thing than saying the commission approves what happened.
Well,
I mean, it's just like if you have a court of appeals decision, everybody decides we're not going to take it any further. That doesn't mean the Supreme Court's approved what they've done. It just means that they're not going to take it any further.
But functionally what happens in the testimony in the case is from Ms. Perrineau and Ms. Cash that what happens when no one appeals it, as a matter of a ministerial act, it goes to the commission and the commission signs off on it. There's testimony in the record to that effect, and that is operative way that it becomes final. And that's why I think 134H refers to a decision becoming final as opposed to being final. Because if you look at 143057, which is the alternate route, the independent hearing examiner route, that decision is final. That section says the decision of the hearing examiner is final.
Well, we're dealing with a penal statute. I mean, how much was Mr. Jackson making a year?
No, Your Honor, I don't even honestly know that. That wasn't even in the record.
Well,
but
he's given a penalty award of almost $500,000 for a two-year period, right?
Well, no, he's given a penalty award of $1,000 a day, and the person with the control to cut that off was the fire department.
Stop and answer my question.
Okay.
He got $500,000 for less than two-year period. So unless he's making $250,000 a year, which he's probably not, maybe he is, maybe we should all quit and go work at the fire department. What, I mean, is he making anything like that?
No.
So this looks like a penal statute. He's making multiple times what he would have made. I guess in addition to it, this is in addition to his salary because he kept working. So this is a $250,000 a year bonus. That looks rather penal. And so we've got to strictly construe this thing. How do we strictly construe when we've got to imply in and take somebody's oral testimony about what's really done, none of which is in the statute?
First of all, when you're talking about strictly construing it as a penal statute, I think you have to approach the very first step and that is, in this case, the city is asserting excessive fine on its own behalf. It is trying to claim a personal right, which it doesn't have. And, you know, the Texas courts, Nutzi and Wilson and Proctor versus Andrews, and even in the Court of Appeals cases, they all recognize the distinction between a municipality coming forward and asserting a constitutional right on its own behalf versus asserting that constitutional right for the purpose of a statute that it's charged with the responsibility to enforce. So there is the first step that we have to address is the cases that Mr. Holman has brought to the court saying that this statute should be strictly construed would be effective, if this was a case by a private party against the state, or if this was a case by Mr. Jackson against the state, or if this was a case, but the statute is imposed by the state against the city. The statute clearly says that the city shall pay to the firefighter $1,000 a day if they intentionally disregard our mandate to them to follow the civil service.
Let's talk about that just for a second. 143-134H says the penalties imposed if the department head intentionally fails. Now, how is that the case here? There's apparently no evidence that the chief, fire chief himself intentionally failed to implement. And so how, by construing the statute, do we arrive at a finding or a holding that there's evidence that the chief intentionally failed?
Okay. I think what we've done is we've broken that down into two elements. One, his knowledge of the award, and secondly, circumstantial evidence of his intent. First of all, we have, under even under the City of Keller versus Williams standard, the court recognizes that when there's conflicting circumstantial evidence, that it is within the province of the jury to disregard evidence. We have direct evidence that the chief received a copy of the original award. That is the evidence of Roland Bienvenu, in which he testified that he sent a copy to the department head. Additionally, we have the testimony of the chief's attorney, Cheryl Cash. She testified that all the persons had been involved, had been notified. Everyone with an interest had been notified. She also testified that it was within the chief's province to make a decision about the appeal, that she would not have made that decision for him, and whether to go forward to a step four grievance. Now, the fact that she doesn't recall specifically talking to him about this particular grievance doesn't mean that that's not no evidence. It is a logical inference. It's a bridge between the decision coming to the City of Houston's personnel office and getting into the chief's hands.
So do you agree that the intent has to be the chief's intent and not an agent or designee or someone down the line?
I believe that the chief's intent, it has to be the chief's intent, but I believe that the chief's intent can be proven by circumstantial evidence. I don't think we have to have a concession that the chief says, I did it. And I think that the case law, which is cited in the brief, and just it's well founded in our jurisprudence that an issue of intent may be established by all kinds of circumstantial evidence. And even in the criminal courts where we're proving intent beyond a reasonable doubt, it can be proven solely on the basis of circumstantial evidence. And that can include subsequent acts of the department, of the chief. We have, just to summarize for the court here, you have Ms. Cash's testimony, which I've already referred to, that she wouldn't have made the decision and that everyone was aware of the decision. You have the statutory regulation of Chapter 143 itself, which says the chief is the one that has to make the decision on transfers. You have the departmental policy, which the record reflects was issued by the chief, that says the chief has to make the transfers. You have Ms. Perrineau's testimony that throughout the time that she was seeking the clarification order from the commission and from Ms. Corroy, she was exchanging correspondence with Ms. Cash, the chief's attorney. You have correspondence from Ms. Cash to Ms. Perrineau taking the position that she was aware that Mr. Jackson had requested the transfer to 11D, and that and she refers to it, and I think that's Plaintiff's Exhibit 6. You have the fact that Ms. Perrineau took the language from Ms. Cash's letter and went to the commission on the very day that Mr. Jackson was trying to grieve the fact that he had not had his decision implemented, and told the commission that Mr. Jackson had never asked for the request, when in fact Ms. Perrineau's own correspondence that predates that concedes that he had asked for the asked for 11D and that he was entitled to it, and her subordinate had proposed 72D as an alternative, as as a settlement, if you would, because someone else had already been given 11D. You have the fact that Mr. Leggio, even though Chief Leggio says he never told the chief directly about Mr. Jackson's request, he conceded that he told his supervisor, the assistant chief, about it. Now, it's a logical inference that within a department like the City of Houston Fire Department, information flows up a chain of command.
Just because they knew it doesn't necessarily mean that they intended not to implement it. It could have just been negligence.
But you have the subsequent conduct trying to prevent Mr. Jackson from getting his transfer.
Well, I read the brief that he got a transfer, just didn't get the transfer that he wanted.
He didn't get a transfer. The city found he never waived it. The jury question that was asked, upon which the trial court cut off the penalty, was when the chief's intent ended. But the jury also found that Mr. Jackson never got his transfer, and the judgment ordered his transfer. This was a case seeking mandamus relief to enforce his right to 11D. The court ordered the transfer to 11D. And the city responded in request for admissions to the trial court that he had never been given his transfer. He was not given his transfer until the trial court entered its judgment mandating that he be given his transfer. And then the parties entered into a Rule 11 agreement substituting a different station for 11D because the judgment itself directs that he be given the transfer to 11D under the original order. So he was never given the transfer. He was given a transfer after this case was tried.
What would be the motivation of the fire chiefs to not want to transfer this guy?
There's testimony in the record reflecting that this was the first time in 30 years that any firefighter had ever been awarded a transfer by the fire department, by the Civil Service Commission. There's also indication in the legislative history of this statute that the reason it was implemented is there had been a problem with the department not wanting to recognize the interference of the commission in its ability to govern its own affairs. And there's evidence in this trial that everyone that handled Mr. Jackson's grievance, transfer request, et cetera, in this case, violated the Texas Civil Service law over and over. That in and of itself is an indication of an intent to circumvent the authority the state has over the department.
You mean they were just mad at him for having done this?
If you trace it back to the origins of this transfer request, there was a dispute between Mr. Jackson and his supervisors outside of the department on totally non-departmental issues. That's why back in November he requested a transfer out of that station.
That translates into the fire chief intentionally denying him this transfer.
Well, you know that the fire chief knew about the transfer request because he has to implement it, and you know that the fire chief has to send a designated representative to grievance proceedings, and that the statute says it should be an assistant chief. If the fire chief had followed the statutory mandates and indeed the mandates of his own policies, which he now, then he would not be in a position to know, to deny that he knew it. But they over and over and over again circumvented the policies of the department and the statute by letting Chief Leggio handle the grievance over 72D. He wasn't qualified under the statute. By trying to impose on Mr. Jackson, according to Chief Leggio, the requirement that he submit some extra form for a transfer, which he never gave him. That's disputed testimony. Mr. Jackson said he was never requested to submit a letter. That's exclusively within the jury's province to decide that issue. You have directly conflicting testimony about whether or not Mr. Jackson was asked to submit something else.
Let me get back to the statute, if I can. Under H, there are two parts to it. If the decision of the commission under 143-131 or the decision of a hearing examiner, you're going with the first part, right? You'd agree that this is not the decision of a hearing examiner under 143-129.
Actually, I wouldn't, and that was the second part when I got distracted on the evidence, because I think that if the legislature had intended to restrict that provision to an independent hearing examiner, then that would have said 143.057 there. Because 143.057 is the part of the statute that refers to the independent hearing examiner.
Well, but if you look at the text of 143.129, it says you can either go to independent third-party hearing examiner pursuant to 143.057 or go this other route.
Right.
And so clearly by choosing hearing examiner and not taking the hearing examiner route, it seems to me that you don't fall under that second part of H.
The second part being becoming final?
No, the second part of H being or the decision of a hearing examiner.
Well, 129 refers to both hearing examiners, and it's important to recognize that the grievance examiner under that parallel route is the only hearing that's conducted for a firefighter. Even if it goes to the commission under the operation of the statute, the commission cannot conduct an evidentiary hearing. If the firefighter or the department appeals it to the Court of Appeals, it is a substantial evidence review. It's a question of law. It's not a new hearing. It's based upon the hearing.
Well, but the legislature could have easily said, or a decision under Section 143.129, and they didn't. They said hearing examiner under 143.
They did say 129. They just didn't say 1057, and that's my point, because if they wanted to limit it to an independent hearing examiner, they could have referred to 057, which is the independent hearing examiner.
Well, okay, let me just get away from that for 1 second. The first part, if the decision of the commission under Section 143.131. So we turn to 143.131A, which we were talking about earlier. Neither party appeals. Let's say the commission finds out about the decision, even though it's not appealed, and they don't like the decision. What do they do? They have no authority on their own to tinker with that decision.
With the,
unless
the commission?
Unless the appeal process has been instituted.
They approve the final decision if it's deemed accepted, and if it's not... If someone appeals it, then they review the transcript of the grievance examiner, and they can change, accept
right.
or reject the recommendation.
But if nobody appeals it, they can't do anything, right?
They approve it. They go through and they sign off on it, basically.
And is that in the record, the signed off approval?
Yes, that is in the record, that they signed off on it. And if you'll give me a second, I will tell you exactly where that is.
I'd like to know.
It's in Ms. Perrineau's testimony, and basically she said...
But there's not a document.
No, the second clarification order was not adopted, but the first order was.
Well, no. I know you're saying her testimony is that the commission adopted it, but is there a document signed off on, as you just said, approving it?
I do not believe that okay. The exhibit from the commission signing off on it is in the record. There's just the testimony from Ms. Perrineau that they had approved it. And you have the exhibit that shows, if you look at the exhibit from when she took it to the commission for the clarification order, it shows the process by which they go through and just sign off on everything that comes before them. And basically, she just said that when no one appeals it, it just gets put on the agenda.
Okay, but there's no docket where the commission has approved it under 130.
I don't believe that's in the record.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Mr. Holman, you were talking about excessive fines, and you seem to be indicating a belief that this excessive fines provision of the Texas Constitution clearly has, in your view, a substantive element. I believe it has a procedural element as well.
I think it could be. I think in this case we're talking about the substantive element. We're talking about the fact that this is an arbitrary penalty. It's a penalty that's not capped in any regard. There's no range of penalties provided, and it creates a windfall for the firefighter.
So if we find that in any statutes, I mean, there are federal statutes that are penalties per day that are not capped, that don't have a range, then as a matter of law, those are all unconstitutional.
Well, unfortunately, the federal courts have held that the Eighth Amendment of the federal Constitution does not apply to civil penalties. So we would never get into that as far as the Texas...
or any Texas statute. With those elements that you just mentioned, they're not capped, there's a range, there's no range of penalties stated, then as a matter of law, those would not survive.
As this court said in Pennington versus Singleton and in State versus Galveston, the determination of whether the fine is excessive is a question of law for the court, and it's determined based on the facts of the particular case.
The U.S. Supreme Court has said that there's a substantive element regulating civil penalties under its due process clause.
In the due process clause, correct.
And so that's you think our Constitution is different then from the U.S. Constitution?
No, I think we read that the same way.
But we read the excessive fines provision, in your opinion, differently from the federal Constitution.
Well, no, I didn't mean to say that. I think we under our jurisprudence, Texas holds that our excessive fine clause applies to civil penalties. Now, we also have a due process.
So that's a difference.
It is a difference, just in conceptually, it's a difference because the Eighth Amendment doesn't apply to civil penalties. But the way that the court gets there, for example, under punitive damages and everything, is under the due process. In the federal courts. That's how they view statutes, federal statutes under the due process law. And we also apply our due process language to the to excessive fines. But we also can look at it whether it's an excessive fine under our Constitution. And so we have a two-prong attack. We can look and see whether it's a violation of due process by being oppressive and arbitrary substantively. Or whether it's an excessive fine by being grossly disproportionate to the damages and the harm claimed. Now, there are two points that were raised, and I want to clarify them. First of all, I have gone through this record with a fine-tooth comb. I do not see anywhere in this record where anybody testified that the commission signed off on Ms. Cora's recommendation. Ms. Cora's recommendation, because it was not appealed, was never taken to the commission. Later on, when Ms. Perrineau sought clarification, she put it on the civil service agenda document, but by her own testimony, they took no action on it. And it wasn't an appeal. It wasn't a timely appeal.
If neither party appealed under 143.130,
right.
And the commission found out about this decision and wanted to do something about it, could they take it up on their own?
No. They have no jurisdiction unless the people appeal. And the way that you do that is by filing a Step 4 grievance form within 15 days after the decision. If you don't do that, the commission has no jurisdiction. In fact, Ms. Perrineau admitted that they didn't really have any jurisdiction to do her clarification. It could have been one reason why they took no action.
Mr. Holman, can you address the response that the chief's intent can be established by circumstantial evidence in this record?
We agree. Most of the time, you can't establish someone's intent by direct evidence. And, you're never going to get the wrongdoer on the stand and do like Perry Mason to admit that he did the wrong. But so you have to establish intent by circumstantial evidence. But this court has clarified what sort of circumstantial evidence that must be. It must be evidence from which you can draw a reasonable inference that the conduct was probable, that the intent was probable. And the way that you do that under the Spolgera case, Spolgera versus Personal Lines with the Personal Tours, which is the landmark case on intent to defraud, is you look at the person's conduct. You look at what they discussed with other people. You look at what their paper trail was. And you determine from that what their intent was.
Isn't that a fact issue for the jury to decide then?
If there's circumstantial evidence, if the circumstantial evidence is not speculation, then yes, it's for the jury to decide. But here, it's complete speculation and suspicion.
If it's your view, conceptually, as you say, that the excessive fines provision applies to civil penalties, and you cite support for that, is it also does it also apply a ceiling to punitive damages?
Well, I don't think in Texas it would, because we have a ceiling statutorily. In Pennington versus Singleton, the court said that the DTPA treble damages provision was not a violation of excessive fines clause, but the reason it wasn't is because it was proportionate to the actual damages.
Without a statutory cap, though, it could apply.
Correct.
In your view?
I agree.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.